content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading from Reminisce Magazine. As a follow-up to some articles or some travel articles that I read for you last month, I'm going to continue that in a section that's titled, What a Trip. A sunny day and a full tank are all it takes to heed the call of the open road. Seeing the country by car has been part of our culture since we've had roads to drive on and maps to guide us. And my first article is titled, Maps Ride Along. Before Global Positioning Systems, maps by Rand McNally and Gusha, along with guidebooks by the American Automobile Association and others, were fixtures in car glove compartments. And here are just some dates for you on how things have progressed with maps. In 1904, Rand McNally's first road map shows streets in and around New York City. In 1906, AAA's official automobile blue book recast traditional bicycling guides for motorists. In 1924, Auto Chum is the first edition in what will become the popular Rand McNally Road Atlas. In 1926, Harry M. Gusha, former head of Rand McNally's Auto Trails Department, forms his own business to make route maps for oil companies. The folding maps are given out for free at gas stations. In 1940, Thomas Brothers Maps relocates to Los Angeles. The company's fold-up maps are designed to fit in a man's suit pocket, and they're popular with California's travelers. In 1960, the Rand McNally Road Atlas is published in full color for the first time. And in 2010, AAA offers a free TripTick application for the Apple iPhone. I have an article submitted by Dietrich Gruen of Madison, Wisconsin, and this is titled The Brothers Gruen, A Tale of Two Guys, One Bug, and Five Flats in the American West. Our story begins in Pleasantville, New York, a village about 30 miles north of the Big Apple. When I was growing up there, our schools had about 100 kids per grade. The extent of my travel experience consisted of visits to grandparents in Ohio and to cousins in Michigan. That is until 1971, when my brother Bill and I spent the summer trekking through the West, relying on a shaky baby blue Volkswagen Beetle to carry us from one landmark to another. Our first base camp was Grand Lake, Colorado, west of Rocky Mountain National Park, where there had been a recent report of a fatal bear attack. Undaunted, we kept on, and as only teenagers do. As if rebelling against our folly, the VW Bug had the first of its five flats that morning. In retrospect, we were idiots to pack so much into our first day, but we weren't thinking about moderation. Did I mention that we were teenagers? Before starting our trip, I spent 6 weeks in the Western Mountains, 4 at a Christian leadership conference near Pikes Peak, and 2 at the Boy Scouts Philmont Scout Ranch in New Mexico. Bill had no such altitude conditioning. Within 24 hours of his stepping off the plane from New York, we were scaling the trail up to Lake Verna, altitude 10,180 feet. Then, as a side hustle, we tackled Mount Craig, 12,007 feet. We crawled over the last snowpack as Bill's legs gave out and his lungs burned. We limped down the mountain. The Bug limped, too, on its wobbly wheels with a blinking generator light spelling more trouble. A Volkswagen repairman in the wilds of southwestern Colorado proved elusive, so we continued on to Salida, San Isabel National Forest, and Black Canyon of the Gunnison and Mesa Verde National Parks. At one point, too tired to find an official campsite, we made do with an alfalfa patch by the roadside. At the Grand Canyon, we made the long, round trip along Bright Angel Trail in under 48 hours. The heat was almost unbearable, and the whole place felt like a tourist trap. In his travel diary, Bill describes the Grand Canyon as a combination of Coney Island and a Bessemer furnace. We bolted for Utah's Zion National Park, but prospects were sketchy. As Bill wrote, Zion Park greeted us with a lot of hot air and a $2 fee. We greeted Zion with second thoughts. Ignoring a sign that said, trail closed, dangerous, Bill and I plunged into a canyon, but managed to coax the VW, now named Scout, up and down. The next day, we tiptoed up the 1,488-foot rock formation known as Angel's Landing. We reached Wyoming, where we did some horseback riding and arrived at Great Teton National Park. There, we hiked to Lake Solitude, which is 9,048 feet, and settled in for 5 days of pine needle beds, wall-to-wall floral carpeting, and beautiful sunsets. Wrapping up our summer at Yellowstone, we used the last of our 6 rolls of Kodak Instamatic film. Our epic trip, Homerian, Bill called it, forged in us a lifelong love of the mountains and each other. 50 years later, my wife Sue and I retraced the steps Bill and I took together, but that's another story. As an end to the travel stories for the last couple of months, here's a story titled Green Book Leads the Way. As more African Americans sought to travel for business and pleasure in the 1930s, Jim Crow laws in the South and discriminatory practices elsewhere posed severe dangers. Victor Hugo Green had a solution. Green, a mail carrier, and his wife Alma moved to Harlem in 1918 at the dawn of the Harlem Renaissance. Inspired by Jewish travel guides and using his postal workers' knowledge of the city, Green compiled a list of hotels and restaurants that cater to African Americans. The first Negro Motorist Green Book in 1936 was only 10 pages and limited to metropolitan New York. Even so, readers loved it. The guide grew more comprehensive each year. Green gathered information from postal workers in other states and worked with the U.S. Travel Bureau's Negro Affairs Department. By the 1940s, the Green Book listed thousands of businesses across the country that were black-owned or verified to be non-discriminatory. Green's annual print run reached 15,000 copies. Lists were longest for cities, but most areas were represented, however slim the pickings. Alaska, for instance, had just one entry in the 1960 edition. In places where no inns offered lodging to African Americans, the Green Book listed private individuals willing to rent rooms. In 1949, the Green Book expanded to include listings for Bermuda, Mexico, and Canada. Standard Oil SO was an early franchisor to African Americans, and its stations were popular spots to buy Green Books. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, which outlawed segregation of public facilities, made the Green Book obsolete. It ceased publication in 1966. Green predicted its demise, even welcomed it in his introduction to the 1949 edition. It will be a great day for us to suspend this publication, for then we can go wherever we please and without embarrassment. And now I have a couple of articles for you from a section titled Sleep Tight. Beds folded into sofas or hidden behind walls have a fascinating history, and they're still pulling a double duty. I read a couple of these articles for you last month, and now I have a couple of more for today's reading. The first one is titled Safety in Numbers. Three's a good crowd to foil the boogeyman. And this is written by Mark Corey of Santa Ana, California. My family would take trips to the San Bernardino Mountains near the Big Bear area of California in the early 1970s. Every year, we'd rent the same cabin on Lake Gregory. It was tiny and close to town. As we all know, every old cabin comes with a ghost story. Ours had the invisible hand which would grab you while you slept. with what we believed was our resident ghost waiting to terrorize us, none of us kids would get any sleep in our own beds. My siblings and I took to sleeping together in the old, squeaky, bar-in-the-back, fold-out sofa in the living room for the entire trip. Our parents didn't understand why we weren't using our bedrooms. They just thought we were unusually close. And my last article for the Sleep Tight section is titled Flat Out Fun: The New Yorker Answers Need with Stylish Flair. My wife Peggy and I started dating near the end of the school year at Brigham Young University in 1970. When the summer began, she went back home to work while I stayed to work at the campus radio station. Our dates meant a round trip of 80 miles. One Saturday night, we had tickets to a Glen Campbell concert, and we knew it would end late. Peggy's parents graciously invited me to stay over after the concert and then go with the family to church the next day. My assigned sleeping spot was in the family room downstairs on an orange Naugahyde couch in a style called the New Yorker. Bright orange was a common decor tone at the time, but the shape of the couch was new to me. The backrest lifted off to increase the sleeping area. The seat cushion curled up at each end. It would make a convenient built-in pillow for most people, but I'm 6 feet 4 inches tall. Both my head and feet were elevated if I stretched out. Over the summer, I slept on the New Yorker a few times, and I learned the best way to curl up to avoid its shortcomings. I grew rather fond of it. Peggy and I married the following spring. Since the wedding ceremony was in the morning, I slept on the New Yorker the night before, eliminating any danger of sleeping in or getting stuck in traffic. When Peggy's parents were redecorating, they offered us the New Yorker for our basement family room. Our children loved sitting on it to watch TV, and the slick finish was ideal for launching Hot Wheels off the sloped ends. Later, it migrated from our basement to Peggy's brother Mark's place. Our daughter Kimberly loved the color orange, and Mark promised her the couch when she got her own house. Naugahyde enjoyed a great reputation for durability, but after 40 years of family fun, the New Yorker was showing its age. The seat had a couple of small holes and stains, and the stitching was loose in spots. Even so, Kim proudly put it in her new living room. One day, searching for fabric for a different project, Kim and Peggy found some orange Naugahyde that matched Kim's couch. After a complete restoration, the New Yorker is as unique looking as ever, and now it's ready for the next generation to enjoy. And this article was submitted by Chris Black of West Jordan, Utah. And now I've got some short articles for you with things that were going on in 1973. The first is titled Energy Crisis. Arab oil producers cut off exports to the U.S. in October 73 to protest American support of Israel in the Yom Kippur War, and the effects are far-reaching. Oil prices quadruple. Cost per barrel nears $12, and gas per gallon rises 37%. Officials order rationing, and long lines of vehicles form at filling stations. A stock market crash ushers in an economic recession that lasts through 1975. Interstate speed limits drop to 55 miles per hour, and the government orders year-round daylight saving time to conserve energy. States ask residents to cut back in other ways, such as eliminating Christmas lights. American energy companies hunt for new oil sources to ease reliance on the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. And stagflation becomes a familiar term to describe stagnant growth in times of high inflation. And then my next article for you is also in 1973, and the title is The Sting Is All the Buzz. Most Oscar winners from the 1970s had a distinct edge to them. The Godfather, The Deer Hunter, even Rocky and Annie Hall showcased humanity's dark side or had something serious to say about life in these United States. not the sting. The light-hearted portrait of Depression-era con men never took itself seriously, yet it dominated the Oscars. It won for picture, director, original screenplay, art direction, costume design, editing, and adapted score. It earned additional nominations for cinematography, sound, and actor Robert Redford. It's a shame Redford's co-stars, Paul Newman and Robert Shaw, weren't among the nominees, because The Sting perfectly balances the three film archetypes and the actors who play them. The new kid, Redford, the old pro, Newman, and the rich villain, Shaw. The plot is simple but effective. After his friend is killed, Redford teams up with Newman to fleece the man responsible, who is Shaw, using an elaborate scam. There are twists and turns, wonderful character bits, and an evocative, if sanitized, recreation of the 1930s, which led to those art direction and costume design Oscars. The Sting was everywhere in 1973. It ruled the box office, and composer Marvin Hamlisch's arrangement of Scott Joplin's The Entertainer eventually reached number 3 on the Billboard 200, an impressive achievement for a decades-old ragtime composition. And by the way, writer David S. Ward returned in 1983 with The Sting 2, starring Jackie Gleason and Mac Davis. Skip it at all cost. And from the word wise section, in 1973, this word became popular: food processor. Carl Sundheimer, a physicist and a foodie, based his design for a food processor for home cooks on a multifunction industrial device he admired in France. Merriam-Webster added the term the same year Sundheimer released the Cuisinart in 1973. The fancy blender and more retailed at $175, more than $1,000 today. But it took the hassle out of chopping, slicing, grating, kneading, and mincing. Americans made room on their kitchen counters for the new gadget, convinced it would help them cook like pros. From the Growing Up section, I have an article submitted by Larry Thomas of Humble, Texas, and it's titled, Choose Your Weapon Wisely. Boys Bring All Natural Arsenal into Play in Pasture Duel. My brother Jerry and I were more than a bit naughty. We enjoyed a colorful, adventuresome childhood with our long-suffering mother Helen and our father Frank, called Zeke, whose hobby was hunting small game and preserving their pelts in our garage. Jerry was younger than I, and we were baptized at the same time in 1949 at the Chelsea Baptist Church in Kansas City, Kansas. But we didn't change our frisky ways for the better until we got older. We loved trips to our uncle's farm outside of Kansas City. Uncle Robert had a mob of chickens and a milk cow, Bessie. Tall weeds grew in Bessie's pasture. When they became dry and brittle, they made excellent spears for two battling brothers. One day, my side of the pasture was out of the usual weapons. At first, I avoided Bessie's droppings, which littered the field. But then I noticed that some of the lighter-colored patties seemed to be dry. I gingerly picked up one of the discs. It smelled a bit like dried grass. I launched my frisbee, and Jerry recognized the missile for what it was. To retaliate, he sought a patty of his own. But having done no research, he didn't understand that not all cow pies are alike. He picked up the first one available, which was fresh. His fingers sank into the mess, and he ran for the stream at the bottom of the hill, screaming for our mother all the way. The next article I have for you is titled, On the Spot Glamour Girl. The diary details Mom's day in the sun, and this is submitted by Susie Sims Fletcher of Astoria, New York. My mother, Dorothy, called Dottie, kept her teenage diaries wrapped in tissue in an upstairs drawer. I started reading them, lovely penmanship, creative spelling and all. From time to time, I'd laugh out loud and read one to Mom. She'd supply details about the diary entry. The boy who crashed his car into a tree because he turned to look at Mom and Mary McNeil walking down the street. Her trick of talking endlessly to avoid an unwanted kiss, and babysitting, homework, phone calls, dresses, and dances. Two entries from 1954 recall Dottie's unexpected turn as a model when she was 15. Chaperoned by a set of parents, the girls in Kappa Beta Psi sorority at Woodrow Wilson High School in Washington, D.C., drove to Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, for a two-week stay in a cottage. The girls were keeping an eye out for boys on the beach when a lifeguard ran up, grabbed Dottie's wrist, and practically dragged her to the lifeguard stand. All arms and legs at 5 feet 11 inches, she must have looked like a cartoon stumbling after him. "Here's our girl," he said to someone holding a camera. The man was Washington Star photographer Paul Schnick, who was working on a feature about lifeguards for the Washington Star pictorial magazine. He told Dottie where to stand, closer, and whom to look at, the lifeguards. He had her smile, and smile once more. Then he wrote her name in a little book and left. After the story was published that August, Dottie's neighbor, Paul Miller, a popular senior, came bolting out of his house. "I saw you. I saw you in the Star." Dottie's dad bought a dozen copies of the paper and hung a print of the photo in his office. Her practical mother asked, "Dottie, why didn't you take off your scarf and show them your hair?" She hadn't had the time to think of uncovering her auburn page boy, which was under wraps to protect it from the sun and wind and to hide the bobby pins, setting the curls she needed later. After all, it was a date night. From the Brush with Fame section, we have an article submitted by Tom Mache of Lawrence, Kansas, and it's titled, "Alex Haley Talks Family." When the Board of Education in Dayton, Ohio, hosted a fundraiser dinner for its Head Start program in 1982, my wife Virginia and I went to see the featured speaker at the event, author Alex Haley. I was an editor in nearby Sydney. I met Haley months earlier after his keynote address at the California Writers Club. This time I hoped to interview him. After Haley finished his speech at the fundraiser, I reminded him of our previous meeting. He invited us to his hotel room to talk. I was nervous about interviewing such an important writer, but he put me at ease. He offered us sweet potato pie and talked about his family, including his parents, Simon and Bertha, his brothers, George and Julius, and his many cousins. We learned that his maternal grandmother, Cynthia, told him about a slave named Kunta Kinte and piqued his interest in learning about his family tree. Haley's extensive genealogical research going back seven generations led to his novel, Roots. The story of Kunta Kinte is the story of all black people whose ancestors were slaves, he said. I remember my surprise that such a famous person as Haley would treat me as an equal. His manner toward us showed no hint that he held such an esteemed position in the world of literature. And then here are some other facts about Alex Haley, who lived from 1921 to 1992. He began writing when he enlisted in the Coast Guard in 1939. In 1949, he was named the branch's chief journalist. After retiring from the Coast Guard in 1959, Haley became a full-time writer, contributing articles to national magazines, including Reader's Digest and Boy's Life. A series of interviews with civil rights activist Malcolm X led to Haley's first book in 1965, the best-selling The Autobiography of Malcolm X. Haley's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Roots, The Saga of an American Family, published in 1976, was made into a TV miniseries the following year. The novel has since been published in 37 languages. And Mary Liz Shaw submits an article titled, "Instant Gratification, Just Add Water is the Slogan of the Dried Food Era." When Lipton introduced cup of soup 50 years ago, the trend for powdered and dried food that had been building for years took a new turn. The company already had a winner with its dried onion soup mix, introduced 20 years earlier. West Coast cooks elevated it to food legend by making it the key ingredient of California dip. By 1972, cultural shifts contributed to the success of cup of soup and convenience food in general. In more than one-third of American households, both parents worked full-time. Single-serve soups, among other child-friendly mixes, meant latchkey kids could help themselves to a snack after school. Other trends helped, especially the letting go of strict proprieties about when food should be consumed. Breakfast at 8, lunch at noon, dinner at 6. Now you could eat when you were hungry, and a hot meal didn't have to take hours, only as long as it took water to boil. As Japanese entrepreneur Momofuku Ando, who introduced his cup noodles to Americans in 1973, observed, "I'm not selling instant noodles. I'm offering customers time." And as a side note to that article, I have some other information for you about convenience foods. In 1938, after years of trial and error, Nestle brings a water-soluble coffee drink, Nescafe, to its Swiss consumers. Research began after the stock market crash of 1929, when the French and Italian Bank of South America was struck with a surplus of Brazilian coffee after the price collapsed. Could Nestle, the bank wanted to know, do something with all this coffee? Chemist Max Morgenthaler found that grounds mixed with high levels of carbohydrates preserved coffee aroma and taste. High pressure and temperature gave the mixture a longer shelf life. In 1948, Nestle Quick, an instant chocolate powder soluble in milk, debuts in the U.S. In 1957, General Foods comes up with Tang, a sugary orange drink mix. In the early 1960s, the space program underway, NASA contracts with General Foods to buy the powder in bulk. So begins an association that Tang marketers will capitalize on for years. Tang was among several dried foods that accompanied John Glenn on his space flight in 1962. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Reminisce. Be sure to tune in next time, and I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Reminisce is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And again, the number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.